Sometimes songs can be portals to a specific time and place. And in this episode, we take an audio tour of Oakland throughout the ages, courtesy of our guest selector, a history buff who's rooted in the town. What is up, folks? Welcome to another edition of Select Five, a show where you get to know Bay Area creatives and community builders through a conversation about five songs that matter to them. It's me again, your host, Pam Torno. I'm here at Bar Shiru, smack dab in the heart of Oakland, a place with a rich and varied musical history, which happens to be the subject of this episode. And I have the perfect selector to guide us through it. It is none other than Liam O'Donohue, a local journalist and the host and producer of East Bay Yesterday, a podcast that explores the stories of culture, politics, and nature from Oakland, Berkeley, and all around Alameda and Contra Costa counties. And I love the tagline for the show, which is a podcast about history that's not stuck in the past, because I think Liam does an amazing job of diving into the archives and interviewing all kinds of people who can connect the East Bay's past with the present, so we can maybe think about a better future. Liam's been producing East Bay Yesterday since 2016, though I didn't discover it till early in the pandemic, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Naturally, some of my favorite episodes are the deep dives into music subcultures, like Oakland's raver scene in the 90s, or the East Bay punk explosion. He's even done an interview with one of my heroes, the legendary Oakland soul singer, Sugar Pie DeSanto. Plus, he doesn't just tell you about our local lore. He will also show it to you in his regular boat tours of the East Bay's waterfront history. And one of these days, I'm going to take one of those tours. So in very on-brand fashion, Liam's song picks for this episode are ones that have a lot of cultural and historical significance for Oakland and, dare I say, for the world. But he also has some personal stories or connections to each one, and I can't wait to hear more. Liam, it's an honor to have you on Select Five.
It's an honor to be here, Pam. Thank you so much for having me. I love music. I love talking about music, and I love your show.
Oh, thank you. So this is actually the first time we've ever had a podcaster on the show. And I have to confess, I've been secretly waiting for the right moment to invite you. And when that moment presented itself, I was like, I scored. So I didn't get too deep into your bio, but I did mention that you're a journalist by trade. You have a monthly East Bay column that you write for SF Gate, and your work's been in a number of outlets, KQED, Oakland Side, Berkeley Side, the East Bay Express, and Salon. I'd love to know a little bit more about how you became an East Bay history buff. Was there like a specific moment or a specific story that you reported on that set you on this path?
You know, it wasn't one specific story. It was just the fact that I have, you know, lived in the Bay for about 20 years now, and my background is journalism. I actually started by writing about music. Even before I moved to the Bay Area, I grew up in the Chicago area. And when I was about 15 years old, I started doing punk scenes. So go to, you know, punk shows at this place called the Fireside Bowl on Fullerton in Chicago. This is like, you know, probably freshman year of high school. And zines were really big back then.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I like writing. I like music. I'm going to interview mostly local punk bands and do the little 8.5 by 11 Xerox folded over zines. And so that was the first time I started doing interviews and writing, you know, I guess what could sort of be considered music journalism. It was, you know, very rudimentary, but that kind of set me on my path of, you know, writing and interviewing people all those years ago. And in terms of focusing on the East Bay, I had gotten laid off in 2016 from my last full-time media gig. I was working for Salon.com, and I had a little time to kind of take a step back and think about what I wanted to focus on. And at the time, the East Bay was changing really rapidly. It was sort of the height of the kind of tech-fueled gentrification. And it felt like a lot of people were leaving the East Bay or getting displaced or pushed out at the same time that a lot of new people were coming here. And so in terms of, you know, what I wanted to focus my life and my journalism on, it felt like East Bay history covered a lot of bases in terms of like preserving and celebrating and sharing the stories of the people who had lived here for generations, who were leaving or whose stories were kind of, I felt like, being overlooked. But it also gave people moving here a kind of easily digestible way, you know, via the podcast to learn about that history and understand this place that they were coming to, which I feel like is really important. And the thing that inspired me, you know, not just kind of like, you know, the sort of political goal of preserving this history and sharing it, but also I just felt like being in the Bay Area, and I'm sure you can relate to this too. I feel like every time I go out to like a party or an event and I talk to someone who grew up here or has been here for a long time, there's like just so many interesting stories around here, so many great storytellers, especially elders. You know, you talk to people who were, you know, part of the Black Panther Party, or there's just, I mean, so many examples of people who have, you know, been through so much in the Bay Area. And it just felt like every time I go out, I'd hear a story that blew my mind that I didn't know before. And I was like, I need to start recording these conversations. So it started very kind of organically, and it just grew from there.
That's awesome. I also think it's awesome that you hone in specifically on East Bay history, because I feel like if it was like a just a greater Bay Area history podcast, that was, I mean, there's already an overwhelming amount of history that's just here. So it doesn't sound like it was so much that East Bay history, or maybe it is, that the East Bay history is like somewhat underrepresented or maybe overshadowed by San Francisco.
Absolutely. Part of my project was inspired by my friends who are San Francisco historians. Uh-huh. So people like Chris Carlson and Lisa Ruth Elliott, who have been doing Shaping San Francisco for many years. They do, you know, tours and programs, and it's like very either low cost or free on this kind of accessible people's, you know, bottom up history. My former boss and good friend David Talbot, he wrote an incredible book about San Francisco history called
Season of the Witch. Yeah.
And like I DJ'd his book release party.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was in this old mattress factory. It was awesome. But so like being around people like Chris and David and Gary Camilla, who wrote Cool Gray City of Love, you know, just kind of, I love San Francisco history, but it did feel like there was a lot of people who were doing it and I didn't live in the city anymore. And yeah, it felt like a lot of those stories have been done. Whereas with East Bay history, I think, you know, people are familiar with the Black Panther Party or a lot of sports history. People are familiar with the Raiders, the Warriors, the A's, et cetera. But, you know, I've been doing this show for like 7 years. I've done over 100 episodes and my list of topics that I want to cover just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. I'm constantly, even though I've been, you know, obsessed with East Bay history for 7 years, I'm constantly still learning new things. So there's no shortage of, you know, interesting rabbit holes to fall down.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, because you had referenced just how, like, how rapid the changes have come to the Bay Area, specifically the East Bay. Yeah. And it's just like, we're constantly making new history. So you never run out of stories to talk about. And I was just wondering, how do you pick your topics?
Well, I do have a list of things that I want to cover that just keeps getting longer and longer, as I mentioned. Part of it is I like to mix it up. You know, I don't like to just cover politics or just cover music. I like to, you know, cover the whole diversity of East Bay history. Mm-hmm. Some of it is really random. It's just like someone's coming out with a book that looks interesting and I'll interview them. Other times I get a lot of like tips. Like I do, you know, I used to do walking tours. Now I'm doing boat tours and people will be like, did you know about this or that? Or people email me out of the blue with story ideas. One thing that I do try to prioritize is interviewing people who are a little bit older. So folks who are in their 70s, 80s, even older than that. I interviewed Betty Reed Soskin, the famous park ranger from Rosie the Riveter, when she was 100. She's still around. Shout out Betty Reed Soskin, amazing woman. But people who are in their 80s, 90s, I feel like a lot of them have never even been interviewed before. And they've just opened up to me with these just incredible stories. Like I interviewed someone like a year or two ago who told me about remembering opening day of the Bay Bridge. She was a little girl and her dad was in the Navy's marching band and she was on the Bay Bridge the day that it opened. Or I did an event a couple years ago and a guy was there who remembered seeing Amelia Earhart take off from the Oakland airport. And I was like, how old are you? But I feel like a rush to kind of capture these stories of people who are getting older because, once they pass away, you know, those stories are, gone forever. And sometimes people have given interviews or shared their stories in other places, but other times not so much. And I have so many regrets about people who I didn't get a chance to interview. The one that's on my mind right now is Calvin Keyes, who just passed away. Great Bay Area jazz guitarist, put out a couple legendary albums in the early 70s on Black Jazz Records, which we're going to be talking about more in a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. But he just passed away, you know, rest in peace. And he was in his 80s. And he was on my list. I was like, oh, you know, one of these days I'll talk to him. And he didn't even live that far from me. I think he lived in Cleveland Heights. And like, I'm just kicking myself now. Like, I should have prioritized getting over there and talking to him. And so it's a bummer. But there's still a lot of people who I plan on talking to soon. I mean, my most recent episode is with a guy, Schultz, who used to own part of the Fifth Ave Marina, this kind of legendary sort of artist compound on the waterfront. And he's 88.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I feel like the older people get, like, the more stories they've collected over the years. So I love talking to elders.
Yeah, it's really important to preserve those stories for sure. So you mentioned this already, but fun fact about Liam, you also are a DJ. You do some DJing on the side. Would you say that East Bay music plays a big role in your DJ sets?
I would say yes. So I started DJing when I was in college, like 99, 2000 or so, I think is when I got my first, set of Technique 1200s, of course. Uh-huh. And, when I started, it was more like kind of rave music, like house music, you know, being from Chicago, that was huge. And, drum and bass, jungle. But then when I started doing like warehouse parties and house parties in the Bay Area, when I moved here in 2003, I realized pretty quickly that if you put on Mac Dre or E-40 or Keek the Sneak, people would just go absolutely nuts. And as a DJ, you love seeing that kind of reaction. Like, uh-huh, people sing along to every word, you know, going dumb. And yeah, I didn't. When I first came to the Bay Area, I would say I listened to more like kind of like conscious stuff, more like Zion Eye, like in terms of Bay Area music, like Zion Eye, Lyrics Born, The Coup, Blackalicious, you know, DJ Shadow, kind of like that sort of world of Bay Area hip hop music. But then as a DJ, I realized like it's the hyphy. It's the hyphy tunes that get the dance floor going. And so ever since then, there's been a couple hyphy tracks that I just come back to again and again, staples. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later.
Yeah, it sounds like you're raring to go.
Well, your job as a host today, I feel like, is going to be to like slow me down, because I can literally talk about music all day, every day. I love this topic.
No, I love it too. But it's going to be tough for me to rein you in. So Liam, you're going to take us through a brief history of Oakland in these five songs curated, and we're going to start way, way back in 1959. A timeless jazz classic, the Dave Brubeck Quartet with Take 5 from the album Time Out. Dave Brubeck is obviously synonymous with West Coast jazz. Liam, what do you want us to know about the song?
Well, I mean, this is a song that I'm sure everyone on the planet has heard at least once.
Yeah.
It's been in commercials. It's been in, movies and things like that. So I think it's actually the best-selling jazz single of all time. I think Kind of Blue, you know, Miles Davis is the best-selling full album, but I think it's Take 5 that is, you know, the best-selling jazz single of all time. So, but it's not played out to me. It's still, every time I hear
it's such a
timeless song. But it took on a new meaning for me personally last year, because I got to go to Dave Brubeck's old house.
That's right.
Which was on my Bay Area bucket list for a long time. This is kind of a legendary modernist masterpiece. It's built up in the hills. And I'd seen photos of it, so I knew it was a cool-looking house, but I didn't really know too much about the history of it until it went on the market last year. The old owners put it up for sale, and so I was like, now's my chance. So I was able to visit the house with the real estate agent who was representing it. And I spent, you know, a couple of weeks just digging into the history of Dave Brubeck and the house. And it's such a fascinating story, which I can kind of recap for you.
Yeah, do it.
So Dave Brubeck grew up in Concord in the East Bay. Mm-hmm. After he got out of the military in the 50s, he had, I think his dad gave him like $1,000 or like a little nest egg. So he bought this property up in the East Bay Hills, but it's a weird piece of property. It's like on this kind of rocky outcropping. It's not a flat, you know, parcel of land. It was a tricky place to build. So he didn't build on it right away. Him and his wife would go up there and like sit on this rock and like look out at the sunset and like dream of their future together when they were young. This is before he was even famous. And at the time, Dave Brubeck was just a local jazz cat. You know, he was gigging at places like the Burma Club, which is over on, it used to be over on Lakeshore near Lake Merritt.
Yeah.
And that building is now the Cat House Bar.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so, you know, through that scene, he met this architect, Beverly Thorne, David Beverly Thorne. And it was a young architect, too. You know, young jazz guy, young architect, kind of big dreamers.
Yeah.
And they just ended up, you know, together making this incredible house. It, like, when you're up there, it feels like it's floating because they use these huge cantilevered steel beams to hold it up.
Yeah.
So the house is, like, built on the rock, but it's, like, floating above the forest around it.
It looks crazy. It looks like it could fall.
It's wild. And when you're up in the house, it's got, of course, these huge floor-to-ceiling windows, and you're looking out at the Golden Gate Bridge and Mount Tam and the entire bay. You see the fog rolling in. And so being in that house, it enlightened me about how Dave Brubeck could be so inspired to make the music that is on, you know, the classic Time Out album that Take Five is on. Paul Desmond, his collaborator, wrote Take Five, but the room that they worked on a lot of this music together, and it's this living room overlooking the bay. But it gets even crazier, Pam. There's the rock that the house is built on. It is coming through the floor. They built the house around the rock,
yeah.
And around the rock they made a custom glass table. So it's like this glass table surrounding this boulder in the middle of the living room, looking out at the bay.
Wow.
And like you feel like the decor of the house and the room, it almost feels like you're in like that TV show Mad Men. Like
yeah,
it's very
yeah.
like 50s, like martini glass vibes. But then there's this like very surreal element with this glass table. It's built around a boulder, you know, emerging through the floor. So it's like wild and like birds are flying by. And then after you're in this room and then you listen to the album again, you're like, oh, this music goes perfectly with this space. Like you can almost like on like Blue Rondo a la Turk, you're like, oh, maybe like a bird flew by and that inspired him to do this like doodle, you know, thing.
Yeah.
And so it's just, it was a magical experience to go in the house. And then every time I listen to that album now, I just like I'm transported back there.
Totally. It's like the soundtrack to mid-century America. And I feel like that, you know, especially Take Five. What's weird to me is that, so Paul Desmond wrote that song and Dave Brubeck is like, that is his most famous song by far. And he like just takes a backseat to his bandmates in that song. Cause he's just back there playing that one consistent piano vamp that. And then like, the Paul Desmond does the melody, the saxophone melody that's the thing that everyone's like, that everyone recognizes when they hear that song. So it's kind of like Dave Brubeck is like the steel beams for the artistry of his bandmates in that song.
Yeah, well, I think he was a very humble and down-to-earth guy. And I say that because after the success of that album and that song, he was the first jazz musician ever featured on the cover of Time magazine, which was an absolutely, you know, massive accomplishment. This is back during the era of mass media. So, you know, it was a magazine that was coast to coast in every living room in America. And when people asked him about that honor, he said it should have been Duke Ellington.
Mm.
You know, he recognized that he was like a white person playing a music that really kind of came out of black culture in places like New Orleans and Harlem, for example. And so he always wanted to like elevate the originators of this music and give them props. But also he was, you know, he had an integrated band. So when he would tour and play college campuses, if they were playing somewhere in the South, because this is the 1950s, if they still had segregationist policies. He would refuse to play there.
Nice.
So, you know, I think his music is so famous, but maybe not some of his stances on civil rights issues. And so I think, you know, it's always nice when a musician is actually a good person, because there's so many examples of great musicians who are not good people.
Yeah, you have to feel conflicted about how much you love their art, because they're just terrible people.
I know. I still feel guilty every time I listen to the Smiths. You know?
Yeah. Morrissey's not a great guy. Okay, so there is so much, much more jazz that originated here in Oakland, which we're going to learn a little more about through Liam's second selection. So let's take a listen. We did talk about Oakland's Black Jazz label on our Barshiru 5-year anniversary episode. We didn't get too deep about its co-founder, jazz pianist Gene Russell. That was his track called Black Orchid from his first album on the Black Jazz label, released in 1971. And that's a really great tune. Liam, what is this? Why does the song speak to you?
Well, first of all, yeah, it's just a great tune. I mean, it's, you know, the whole album, you can put it on. There's a great Stevie Wonder cover on it, too.
Yeah.
But I just love that opening track. I feel like it just sets the scene for the whole album. And again, there's just such an interesting history behind this album and Gene Russell's career. So he had been living down in L.A. And, you know, I think he was frustrated by the fact that so many musicians, specifically Black musicians who were playing, you know, jazz, weren't getting good deals, weren't getting good contracts.
Yeah.
And so he decided he kind of wanted to start this label that would give, you know, Black musicians their fair credit and a fair shake. And he didn't start it in L.A. He moved up to Oakland to start it. And if you think about Oakland in late 60s, early 70s, you know, what was going on here, of course, like this is where the Black Panthers were founded. So I think after, you know, Huey and Bobby started the Panthers, it became sort of a magnet for people with that mentality of Black liberation and, you know, promoting sort of Black power, Black identity. And so Gene Russell came here and he just brought so many incredible musicians up here to record or live or play with him. I think Calvin Keyes was also from LA and came up here. I love the tune. And it's interesting because by the early 70s, of course, jazz was like getting really experimental, mm-hmm. really crazy, really out there.
A lot more spiritual jazz.
Yeah, but I mean, that track, Black Orchid, it's got kind of a classic feel to it. You know, it's like very soulful. It's not super experimental. It's just got a great groove.
No, it's almost like Latin jazz-ish.
That's the other thing. Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of the records on Black Jazz sort of bring together these different jazz traditions, so they don't really fit easily in one box, which is really interesting as a listener.
Yeah, it's funny because like I know that Black Jazz was here in Oakland, but I haven't been able to find any information about where were the offices located, where were the recording studios. Do you know anything about that?
Those are great questions. I wish I knew more.
Yeah.
Sadly, Gene Russell passed away pretty young. I think he was in his 50s. He passed away like in the early 80s, I want to say. I've actually been thinking that I should probably reach out to his family. I think his son is still around living mm-hmm. down in LA. And I'd love to know more about the label.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. There was an article in the Washington Post right around when Real Gone had reissued all those records. And there ended up being kind of a dispute about ownership, like who actually owns this music, because he did have a partner, which is Dick Shorey, who was like, he was the wallet, he had the money, but Gene Russell was the A&R guy, and he brought in the music and he produced the artists and all that stuff. And it's, I guess it's just kind of crazy that there's no paper trail sometimes to these things. These are precious. This is precious history, and there's no paper trail.
Musicians aren't notorious for being the most organized people of all time.
They're not.
But yeah, I read that article, and it's very dismaying, you know, for a lot of reasons. The ownership disputes and the lack of paper trail to kind of, you know, figure out exactly who owned the label or whatever. But I think one takeaway that we can get from that story is just that, you know, regardless of the complicated ownership and like sort of all the politics around it, at least the music has been re-released.
Yeah.
Because I could see all the like sort of legal squabbles getting in the way of that music being reissued. And before it was reissued in, you know, all those albums were reissued in like 2020, 2021, they were really hard to come by. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if they were on streaming services. I know that they were like the actual wax, the records were like running hundreds of dollars and super rare.
Yeah.
And so just to have that music, you know, back in the, you know, the public sphere, again, accessible. It's just like kind of a minor miracle.
And absolutely.
I'm so happy. And like, I'm not going to front. I didn't know about it until it was reissued.
So that's
what exposed me to a lot of these guys and that label in general. So I think I'd maybe heard of the label, but wasn't really familiar with it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So we are going to fast forward by 22 years with Liam's third selection. And here it is. About impacts, cause in facts my freestyle talent overpowers brothers can't hack it. They lack wit, we got the max shit. 93 to infinity, kill all that wax. This is how we chill from 93 till. 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 This is how we chill from 93 until. This is how we chill from 93 till. A much loved track around these parts, 93 Till Infinity from The Souls of Mischief, the title track from their debut album from 1993, of course, now widely considered a hip-hop classic. This is, what do you want to share with us about it?
Oh my gosh. It's so hard to know where to start. There's so much to say about this song. It's so legendary. I mean, there's like so much lore around this song. We could talk about the fact that they were like teenagers when they made this. They were so young. So many memories of Hyro Day. Mm-hmm. It was such an influential song. I'll start with Hyro Day. So for anyone who's listening who doesn't know, Souls of Mischief and Hieroglyphics, they do an event in Oakland every year called Hyro Day. I think the first one was on 9-3, as in 93 till infinity. So it's always like Labor Day weekend. And they started doing it maybe like 10, 12 years ago. And I've been to most of them, not every single one, but it started out free, and it's still very, I think last year it was free too. And it's always been really affordable. It's always like $20 at the most on the years they've had to sell tickets. But because Souls of Mischief and Hyro were so influential and have just been around forever and know everyone, they're able to bring in like incredible talent to Oakland to do these like free or super low cost shows. They've brought in, you know, Black Thought and Talib Kweli. And last year they had Common, you know, doing a free show on the steps of Oakland Wow. City Hall. And it's no matter how many times you see Souls of Mischief play 93 Till Infinity, it just never gets old.
Yeah.
Like there's so much energy. The crowd loves it so much. It's such a timeless, you know, instrumental, like the instrumental part of the track is so timeless. I just love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Before the show, I was rewatching the music video and like, they're obviously so young in it.
Yeah,
and
teenagers.
I'm like, where was this shot? Because it looks like they're like outdoors on a river. Like, this looks like it's Yosemite. Where was that rooftop? I don't know if you watched the video.
I think they did film part of it in Yosemite.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a documentary that came out about Souls and Hyro like a year or two ago. That's really cool. You can find it online. So that'll answer all your questions. But I'm just thinking back to when I first learned about this song, because growing up in high school, so I was into hip hop from like a super young age.
Okay.
I think like the first tape I ever bought was like Public Enemy when I was, you know, 10 years old because of Yo MTV Raps.
Of course,
like that is how we learned about rap and hip hop in the 90s if you were like a, you know, a kid in the suburbs or whatever. And first of all, I'm just so grateful to people like Chuck D, because I feel like that influenced my politics going on throughout the whole rest of my life. And then later, you know, groups like Rage Against the Machine and Fugazi, but I'm going off on a tangent now. Back to hip hop. So growing up, I was more into like East Coast hip hop. So like first Public Enemy, and then a little bit later, like Wu-Tang, Nas, Tribe.
And this kind of sounds like an East Coast hip hop.
Yeah,
album.
That's the thing. I wasn't really listening to like a lot of the Bay Area stuff back in the 90s. But then the one big exception was Hyro and Souls. They were just like, they kind of had that sort of more sample based East Coast style. They were like super lyrical. You know, they weren't doing the kind of like mob music, like heavy bass stuff that Too Short and E40 were doing. And yeah, they just like really stood out. And so coming here and getting to see them year after year after year on Hyro Day, it's such a treat.
Yeah. You know, I remember like, and this is dating me, but like, you know, back when I was in college and I remember hearing, and I grew up on the East Coast, went to school in Buffalo, New York, and hearing like Del the Funky Homo Sapien and not realizing that like he was part of this whole, it wasn't until I moved to the Bay Area many years later that I'm like, oh, he's part of this whole Bay Area crew, this Hieroglyphics crew. And
yeah. And so, Ice Cube's cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That I did not know.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I don't think we can talk about Oakland music. We can't talk about Oakland hip hop without talking about the hyphy movement. And here is Liam's selection in that category.
Yee! I'm in the building and I'm feeling like RIP to the Mac, the R.E. Sucker boy, look, that's my word. And underneath my teeth, that's my bird. 50 cow wow, get busy with a big kick. Look up, you dizzy, I'm a big fish. C.A. dollar sign H with a herb at. Shoes on my G-Ride, pull it with a curve at. And bounce out just to check on my trap. Blow the smoke in the air, man, adjusting my hat. Da-da-da-da-da, Fabby Power. The yellow bus rider, shotgun on the Mayflower. Super hype, with about 50 of them thugs. We ain't listening, we getting kicked out the club.
From the glory days of hyphy in the year 2005, this is Keek to Sneak, of course, with his super smash hit, Super Hyphy. And you chose the Thizz remix with Mr. Fab.
Yes, gotta have the whole crew on there.
Yeah. So I think, did you move to Oakland like a little bit right before the hyphy explosion. What do you remember of it? How did you experience it?
I just remember like listening to KMEL. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, driving around or whatever and like turning on 106.1, and it was just so high energy, like all that music back then. It was just like so, I mean, it was party music.
Yeah.
You know? And the other thing was this is like before YouTube even, or like maybe YouTube had just started, but people were, you know, there was kind of like all these bootleg like sideshow videos. So like, you know, remember like in the 90s, people would always have like skateboarding videos and stuff that would get like bootlegged and passed around. There was all these like kind of like low budget or like no budget sideshow documentaries. I think one was called like Sideways, or like, you know, it would be like DeBay's Baddest or whatever. So like it would be these like sideshow bootleg DVDs. And the soundtrack, of course, was all, you know, local hyphy music. And so that was one of the ways that I was like, oh, my God, like this scene is wild. You know, like seeing people ghost riding.
Yeah.
You know, like ghost riding the whip is wild. That's a crazy thing to do. So it just felt like there was like a very like punk rock energy about it. And also, I was kind of like still more into like kind of like the rave scene back then in like early 2000s. And so having done, you know, just to be honest, like my fair share of Molly, and like hearing these rappers talk about like doing Molly, like fizzing,
yeah.
I was like, oh yeah, I get why they're so happy. I get why they're wearing like gigantic sunglasses and like bright clothes. Like when you do ecstasy, as it was called back then, like you want to like jump up and down on a car, like you want to like put on crazy shades and like dance around and like swing your arms everywhere and like just go completely dumb. And so the marriage of like the drug and like the music and the car culture. And like, it just got crazy. Like there was, for a while, people were drinking hyphy juice, which was like Red Bull mixed with like Jose Cuervo or something like that, which was totally nuts. And this was also during the era of like Four Loko and like Spark. So caffeinated malt like liquor was a big
practically
thing.
Practically illegal now.
I'm glad I was in my early 20s, because if I tried to like drink caffeinated malt liquor now, I'd probably die.
Oh, but, yeah. No, that is very, very bad for the heart.
But so this song in particular, okay, I wanted to pick the song because there are so many hyphy staples that like everyone knows. Like they play them during like, you know, the Warriors championship games on like network TV. So like everyone knows Tell Me When to Go. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows Blow the Whistle. Great songs. Not dissing them at all. Love them. But I feel like there's so many other classics that are maybe a little bit less well known. And this is one where if like probably every single party I've ever played in West Oakland, I've like played this song.
Because oh, really?
It's one of those songs. It's like as soon as the doot, 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 Like people will like come running to the dance floor. And not only that, like I've DJed a lot of like backyard parties in Oakland and in West Oakland in particular.
Okay.
And people will like be walking down the street or like be like down the block and they'll hear that and come like running over, like peeking their eyes over the fence. Like, can I come in? You know? And it's like, I feel like it's like the Pied Piper, like calling everyone in the Bay Area to like the dance floor. And just like the reaction is one of those songs that when you put it on, people really do get stupid.
It brings out the crowd.
It's so fun. So fun. Yeah. And just like Keke's flow. There's no one else like that.
Yeah. I mean, and such, he's got gravelly that gravelly voice. Yeah.
And I love like, you know, Mr. Fab on the remix is so good. And it's just like every verse on this track is just unique. And yeah, just another timeless Bay Area hyphy jam. And you know, I actually Keke has had some, you know, he's gone through some rough times over the last few years.
Yeah.
He was shot. He was partially paralyzed. He got locked up for having a gun that he said he had to protect himself against more attacks, which I find a very legitimate reason to have a firearm. And so I saw him. He was doing this little event actually right across the street from here at Oaklandish a couple of years ago. And he was not like, oh, woe is me, you know, blah, blah. He was like, I'm coming back. Like, he's like, I'm in physical therapy. Like, I'm recording. I'm still trying to. So even though he's, you know, been in the game for decades now, you know, he was shot. He was locked up. Like, he's still going strong. And I feel like.
Yeah, he's still
that's
making music.
The spirit of, like, the Bay Area. Like, you can knock us down, but, like, we won't stay down.
He'll, yeah.
So Keke keeps getting back up. And he's just an amazing performer. So shout out Keke the Snake.
Yeah. Well, you know, hyphy doesn't seem like it was all that long ago. neither does this track, though, which is Liam's fifth and final selection. From the multi-talented Brontez Purnell and his punk rock band, The Younger Lovers, this song is called The Ballad of Two Stubborn Men. Brontez Purnell he's a dancer, he's the author of several books, and he's a musician. Is there anything he can't do? what does this song bring to mind for you?
This is one of those songs that kind of transports me, again, back to my sort of early 20s or mid-20s, because it's hard to describe for people who weren't in the Bay Area back in like that era. I kind of call it like the warehouse era of Oakland because this was before people had smartphones, before people had Instagram. Like, you found out about parties in different ways. And if you didn't know what was going on, you could literally hop on your bike and ride around West Oakland on like a Saturday night and just listen. And you could hear like, oh, that warehouse, there's like house music. Oh, that one, there's like a metal show. Oh, there's like a punk thing going on down the block. There was just so many spaces that were old, you know, factories, warehouses, you know, whatever, or just like big old Victorian houses that had like backyards and things, where there was just a huge thriving underground scene. And I love this song. I love Brontez because I think in some other places, like, people take punk a little more seriously. Like, you know, you think of like New York punk and it's like all this like aggro macho energy, but coming to the Bay Area, it was like, yeah, I mean, like this kind of like queer black punk, you know, who's like sort of breaking down all these barriers, but it was so funny too. He was in another band called Gravy Train.
Uh-huh.
And like, so I think of like them and other bands that like Hot Tub who were around at the time who were just like really like kind of like, you know, playing up the kind of like sexiness, but in this kind of like cartoonish over the top way and like really fun and like kind of goofy, but yeah, like super DIY, super underground. And yeah, like I think Brontez and I came to the Bay around the same time. I think he got here like maybe a year or so before I did. I've interviewed him. I've had him on my show and we kind of talked about, you know, coming up in the Bay as young people in our 20s and whatnot. And it just felt like such a magical time when you could come here with like very little money and not have to work a lot and still have like a really cool life. Like, I moved into a old post office. The first place I lived for like the first 2 years I was in the Bay was this old post office at the corner of 16th and Mission that we called Station 40. It was like old post office Station 40. And it was like this big empty space, and we built walls and kind of turned it into an event space and would have huge parties there that we would use to fund our media projects. I was publishing an underground newspaper at the time called Fault Lines, and like we would use the kitchen for like Food Not Bombs, and like everyone was living in spaces like that.
Yeah.
You know, like you just every weekend it was like different warehouse parties. Like if we were trying to throw a show or a fundraiser, there was so many cool places to choose from. And so Brontez's music kind of takes me back to that era when it was just like, yeah, like squat parties, warehouse parties. It was like popping off all over the place. And he's such a, you know, creative person. And also, again, like because we're talking about Oakland history here, the reason Brontez moved to Oakland, because he's originally from Alabama, he told me, is because his uncle, J.J. Malone, was a blues musician in like the 60s and 70s, and he used to play at Eli's Mile High Club all the time.
Wow.
And so he was kind of part of that like Eli's scene. Shout out to Billy and the crew at Eli's. They're still keeping the blues tradition of Oakland alive with their Monday night blues shows. And but yeah, Brontez's uncle J.J. was like, you should come check out Oakland. And he did. And
yeah.
He's been here ever since. And like I used to live on Telegraph, and he I think still lives on MLK. So I'd like always see him riding his bike around. And he's just like one of those like characters of the scene that I feel like are people like the type of people that make this a really, really special place.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to that episode that you did with Brontez, and what's great about it is that, you know, it's you know, you talk about like what it was like then and living in warehouses and, you know, his artistic development kind of mirroring yours as a young, well, although he was, you know, a young queer black punk rocker from Alabama.
Yeah.
And then he came here, went a little wild, and eventually became the highly acclaimed author and is still a prolific musician today.
Yeah.
But the economic conditions of the city at the time, which, you know, allowed you to like take over these warehouse spaces and create this art. And now that's gone.
It was right after the first tech bubble burst.
Wow.
So it was like perfect timing. Cause I think that first bubble, when everyone was like .com, like you got to invest in a .com, like .com was like a new thing. And so, I think that was like probably like 99 through like, 2001, 2002. And after that bubble popped, there was a lot of kind of room for people to come to the Bay and grow and thrive.
I mean, I think it's still kind of lasted a little bit past that. Like I remember I didn't really go to a lot of, I like to use the excuse that I'm too old for it, but I think I just wasn't cool enough for it. But no, I mean, I remember going to like things like Ghost Town Gallery or like First Church of the Buzzard, which are in West Oakland. Like there were some things there. So it still kind of lasted. I think, you know, the Ghost Ship Fire, which was not that long ago, that was kind of the last of that.
Yeah, scene. Exactly. That's so true. It was really, things had been, you know, space had been getting more expensive. Spaces were getting like knocked down, redeveloped. And then also like the cannabis industry started coming in and taking over a lot of warehouses and turning them into grow spaces. The real massive shift happened like after the ghost ship disaster in, I think it was 2016, because I remember it was right around the same time that Trump got elected, and it was just like such a devastating, dark time for like the whole country and for Oakland, and it was horrific. And not only because of all the lives that were lost, the 36 people that died that day, which of course is the greatest tragedy, but then so many people lost their homes after that, including a lot of friends of mine who, you know, as soon as it happened, all the other landlords who, you know, own these properties in Oakland were like, all right, all you artists, all you musicians, all you people who are, you know, living in these spaces, maybe semi-legally or illegally, even though you're paying rent, you know, they're not zoned for residential or whatever, or they're not up to code, you guys are out of here. Instead of giving them a chance to bring spaces up to code or, you know, figure out how to kind of make it sustainable and safe. And then the party scene in Oakland really shifted after that dramatically. I feel like for a couple of years, even people who still had spaces were very squeamish about throwing parties there because they were worried about getting on the radar of the authorities and maybe getting evicted themselves. So that was kind of the outdoor party era. There was a lot of parties like up in various regional parks late at night, underneath the highway overpasses in like West Oakland, for example, and like Lake Merritt. Like people would just throw these like renegade parties all over the place. And, you know, there's like benefits to that, but also you can't really do that in the winter.
Yeah.
A lot of those parties would get busted. And it is nice to have bathrooms sometimes at parties too.
So now that we're older, we want to be more comfortable when we go to these parties.
Exactly. Like I went to an insane rave at the old Greyhound bus station a couple blocks from here San Pablo last year. And it was such a cool space for a party. And it was like a rager. But yeah, no bathrooms. And I was like,
wait, there's bathrooms in
the building, but there's no plumbing or electricity. And I don't think you want to go into the rooms that used to be the official bathrooms because people have been doing things in there that don't smell great for a long time. So we can leave it at that.
Man, that was a real big tangent off of Brontës Brunel. And that song, which I just
like
wanted
Brontës
to...
Brontës would appreciate that tangent.
No, he probably would. He would. No, it's a great... This is exactly the kind of portal that I was hoping the song would take us down. But I just wanted to say that, like, I've never heard the song before, The Ballad of Two Stubborn Men. I feel woefully uncool because I somehow... never heard of The Younger Lovers, even though I, you know, am aware of kind of the contemporary bands around that time, Shannon and the Clams, Hunks and His Punks, No Bunny. I don't know how I never heard of Younger Lovers, and I had never heard of Brontës until last year when he put out his album, No Jack Swing, which I love. Anyway, there's just all to say, just so much to discover about Oakland's musical history that I'm glad that you've put me onto.
Yeah, you know, not long after I did that interview with Brontës for East Bay yesterday, I went to go see him perform at Eli's. And he played this song, and I love the song. It's like, it's just catchy, you know, it's got like a fun energy to it, like the kind of, you know, if you lay me down easy, like at the end, it's very like sing-along-y. Uh-huh. And seeing him on stage playing that with Eli's Mile High sign in the background, I was like, oh my gosh. And
then
I was like thinking
uncle.
About his uncle and like that connection. And also, he's so funny. Like not just like... you know, in his writing, but just like the things he says off the cuff are hilarious. Like when he played that show, I remember I'm totally blowing him up right now, but he advertises like the final Younger Lover show. And I was like, when I saw him at Eli's before he played, I was like, oh, is this like the end of Younger Lovers? He's like, oh, I just say that so people will come out. I'm like, oh yeah, like everyone, like Jay-Z has done that. Like, come on, LCD Sound System. That's
why
like
not
everyone
him too?
Does it. Everyone's like, oh, this is my last tour, like farewell tour. Like, sure, guys. So I think, you know, Brontës has a million different projects. He's so funny, but he's like shameless and hilarious and brilliant, creative person.
Amazing. Well, we could go on forever about great music that's rooted in Oakland, but we've reached the end of this episode, sadly. So, Liam, I know you put together a digital mixtape, if you will, aka Spotify playlist. That's a boring way to put it. But do you want to go through what are some of the honorable mentions, or what was your overall curatorial direction?
The curatorial direction is I wanted to represent like how diverse Oakland's music scene is. So, you know, there's hyphy, there's more kind of conscious stuff like Zion I, you know, that song, The Bay, like, I feel like that's such a great, like, Bay Area song. I always think about when I'm, like, driving on the bridge. There's punk, there's jazz, there's blues, there's a little bit of everything. But if I had to give one shout out to an artist on that list that means a lot to me, it would be, gotta give a shout out to Sugar Pie DeSanto.
Of course, yes. Love her.
She, like, we, or at least I, like, you know, Oakland's blues scene of the 50s is, like, very famous. Like, people talk about, like, 7th Street and Slim Jenkins and all this stuff. But most of the people who were part of that scene are gone. That was a long time ago now. But Sugar Pie DeSanto played those clubs in the 50s. And when I heard her telling me the stories of, like, her personal experience of, like, how wild and crazy it was, like, how much fun she had and, you know, recording in West Oakland with, like, Bob Geddens, who owned this... like local blues label back then, it was like she was bringing these places to life for me in a way that like I could never get from just looking at a picture or reading them in a book. And so Also her energy, you know, she's like in her 80s, and when she I'm not sure if she's still performing, but she was performing a couple of years ago, and she would still like, she would like,
I saw her like maybe 5 years ago. Yeah.
Did she do the thing where she like brought like a big handsome man up on stage and like jumped on top of him and like rode him around?
I don't remember her. I would remember something like that. I don't think she did that.
She's wild. She's crazy. She's still got like
she's an
energy.
Inspiration. I hope I hope I have that much energy when I'm
I love her. Yeah. I love her. Yeah. And she, and like, she would just like tell these stories about like touring with James Brown and stuff like that, that were like mind blowing. You know, she'd be like, James Brown got mad at me because he said, Sugar Pie, you're making me work too hard. Because, like, she was opening up for him, and she would, like, put on such a show that, like, it forced him to get even, like, faster and have more, like, show off his moves, because he had to, like, live up to the energy that she built, you know, in the room. And so, yeah, like, hearing stories about James Brown from someone who, like, toured with him, I mean, come on.
All right, my friends, we are going to post a link to Liam's curated Oakland playlist in our show notes. Go subscribe to East Babe Yesterday if you haven't already subscribed. It really is a fun way to get to know some of the colorful lore behind this unique region we call home. That about wraps it up for me, but if you're still listening at this point in the episode, you really are a true fan. We're glad you like what we're putting out there in the world, and if you do love us, tell the world by giving us a 5-star rating on the platform of your choice. We're writing us a nice review. Here are the folks you can thank. Select Five's producer, Kate Sullivan, technical producer, Brian Douglas, and me, your humble host. Lastly, we show eternal gratitude to Dan and Shireen for letting us record here at Bar Shiru. This is Pam Torno signing off. We'll be back soon. Peace and love, everybody.